It was another rainy evening in the 21st century, and by the time I reached the pub, I was thankful just to be somewhere dry. I found my dad alone, nursing a beer at a table, so I pulled up a chair and began fabricating stories about my day while toweling off my face with napkins. Something I was beginning to discover about lying, the more I did it, the easier it got. He was hardly even listening. "Huh," he'd say. "That's interesting." And then his gaze would drift off, and he'd take another swig of beer. "What's up with you?" I said. "Are you still pissed at me?"
"No, no, nothing like that."
He was about to explain, but waved it away.
"Ah, it's stupid."
"Dad, come on."
"It's just this guy who showed up a couple days ago. Another birder."
"Someone you know?" He shook his head.
"Never seen him before. At first I thought he was just some part-time enthusiast yahoo, but he keeps coming back to the same sites, the same nesting grounds, taking notes. He definitely knows what he's doing. Then today, I saw him with a banding cage and a pair of predators, so I know he's a pro."
"Predators?"
"Binoculars. Real serious glass."
He'd wadded up his paper placemat and re-smoothed it 3 times now, a nervous habit.
"It's just that I thought I had the scoop on this bird population, you know? I really wanted this book to be something special.
And then this asshole comes along.
Jacob.
I mean, this no-good son of a bitch."
He laughed. "Thank you, son. That'll do."
"It will be special," I said reassuringly. He shrugged.
"I don't know. Hope so."
But he didn't sound too certain. I knew exactly what was about to happen. It was part of this pathetic cycle my dad was caught in. He'd get really passionate about some project, talk about it nonstop for months. Then, inevitably, some tiny problem would crop up and throw sand in the gears. And instead of dealing with it, he'd let it completely overwhelm him. The next thing you knew, the project would be off and he'd be on to the next one, and the cycle would start again. He got discouraged too easily. It was the reason why he had 12 unfinished manuscripts locked in his desk, and why the bird store he tried to open with Aunt Susie never got off the ground, and why he had a bachelor's degree in Asian languages but had never been to Asia. He was 46 years old and still trying to find himself, still trying to prove he didn't need my mother's money. What he really needed was a pep talk that I didn't feel at all qualified to give, so instead, I tried to subtly change the subject. "Where's this interloper staying?" I asked. "I thought we had the only rooms in town."
"I assume he's camping," my dad replied.
"In this weather?"
"It's kind of a hardcore ornithology geek thing. Roughing it gets you closer to your subjects, both physically and psychologically. Achievement through adversity and all that."
I laughed. "Then why aren't you out there?" I said, then immediately wished I hadn't.
"Same reason my book probably won't happen. There's always someone more dedicated than I am."
I shifted awkwardly in my chair. "I didn't mean it like that. What I meant was..."
"Shh."
My dad stiffened, glancing furtively toward the door.
"Look quick, but don't make it obvious. He just walked in."
I shielded my face with the menu and peeked over the top. A scruffy-looking bearded guy stood in the doorway, stamping water from his boots. He wore a rain hat and dark glasses and what appeared to be several jackets layered on top of one another, which made him look both fat and vaguely transient. "I love the homeless Santa Claus thing he's got going," I whispered. "Not an easy look to pull off. Very next season." He ignored me. The man bellied up to the bar, and conversations around him quieted a notch or two. Kev asked what he'd like, and the man said something, and Kev disappeared into the kitchen. He stared straight ahead as he waited, and a minute later, Kev came back and handed the guy a doggy bag. He took it, dropped some bills on the bar, and went to the door. Before leaving, he turned to slowly scan the room. Then, after a long moment, he left.
"What'd he order?"
my dad shouted when the door had swung shut.
"Couple of steaks," Kev replied. "Said he didn't care how they were cooked, so he got 'em 10 seconds aside rare. No complaints."
People began to mutter and speculate, the volume of their conversations rising again. "Raw steak," I said to my father. "You gotta admit, even for an ornithologist, that's a little weird."
"Maybe he's a raw foodist," Dad replied.
"Yeah, right. Or maybe he got tired of feasting on the blood of lambs." Dad rolled his eyes.
"The man obviously has a camp stove. He probably just prefers to cook out in the open."
"In the rain? And why are you defending him anyway? I thought he was your arch nemesis."
"I don't expect you to understand," he said. "But it would be nice if you didn't make fun of me."
And he stood up to go to the bar. A few hours later, my dad stumbled upstairs, reeking of alcohol, and flopped into his bed. He was asleep instantly, ripping out monster snores. I grabbed a coat and set out to meet Emma. No sneaking necessary. The streets were deserted and so quiet, you could almost hear the dew fall. Clouds stretched thinly across the sky, with just enough moonlight glowing through to light my way. As I crested the ridge, a prickly feeling crept over me, and I looked around to see a man watching me from a distant outcropping. He had his hands raised to his face and his elbows splayed out like he was looking through binoculars. The first thing I thought was, "Damn it, I'm caught," assuming it was one of the sheep farmers out on watch, playing detective. But if so, why wasn't he coming over to confront me? Instead, he just stood and watched, and I watched back. Finally, I figured, if I'm caught, I'm caught. Because whether I went back now or kept going, one way or another, word of my late-night excursion would circle back to my dad. So I raised my arm in a one-fingered salute and descended into the chilly fog. Coming out of the cairn, it looked like the clouds had been peeled back and the moon pumped up like a big yellow balloon, so bright I almost had to squint. A few minutes later, Emma came wading through the bog, apologizing and talking a mile a minute.
"Sorry I'm late. It took ages for everyone to get to bed. Then on my way out, I stumbled over Hugh and Fiona snogging each other's faces off in the garden. But don't worry, they promised not to tell if I didn't."
She threw her arms around my neck.
"I missed you," she said. "Sorry about before."
"I am too," I said, patting her back awkwardly.
"So, let's talk."
She pulled away.
"Not here. There's a better place, a special place."
"I don't know."
She took my hand. "Don't be that way. You'll adore it, I promise. And when we get there, I'll tell you everything."
I was pretty certain it was a plot to get me to make out with her, and had I been any older or wiser, or one of those guys for whom make-out sessions with hot girls were so frequent as to be of no consequence, I might have had the emotional and hormonal fortitude to demand that we have our talk right then and there. But I was none of those things. Besides, there was the way she beamed at me, smiling with her whole self, and how a coy gesture like tucking her hair back could make me want to follow her, help her, do anything she asked. I was hopelessly outmatched. "I'll go, but I'm not going to kiss her," I told myself. I repeated it like a mantra as she led me across the bog. "Do not kiss. Do not kiss." We headed for town, but veered off toward the rocky beach that looked out onto the lighthouse, picking our way down the steep path to the sand. Reaching the water's edge, she told me to wait and ran off to retrieve something. I stood watching the lighthouse beam wheel around and wash over everything. A million seabirds sleeping in the pitted cliffs, giant rocks exposed by the low tide, a rotted skiff drowning in the sand. When Emma came back, I saw that she had changed into her swimsuit
and was holding a pair of snorkel masks.
"Oh, no," I said. "No way."
"You might want to strip to your skivvies,"
she said, looking doubtfully at my jeans and coat.
"Your outfit's all wrong for swimming."
"That's because I'm not going swimming. I agreed to sneak out and meet you in the middle of the night, fine, but just to talk, not to..."
"We will talk," she insisted.
"Underwater, in my boxers." She kicked sand at me and started to walk away, but then turned and came back.
"I'm not going to attack you, if that's what you're in a knit about. Don't flatter yourself."
"I'm not."
"Then quit mucking about and take off those silly trousers."
And then she did attack me, wrestling me to the ground and struggling to remove my belt with one hand while rubbing sand in my face with the other.
"Pha!" I cried, spitting out sand. "Dirty fighter! Dirty fighter!"
I had no choice but to return the favor with a fistful of my own, and pretty soon things devolved into a no-holds-barred sand fight. When it was over, we were both laughing and trying in vain to brush it all out of our hair.
"Well, now you need a bath, so you might as well get in the damn water."
"Okay, fine." The water was shockingly cold at first. Not a great situation vis-a-vis wearing only boxer shorts, but I got used to the temperature pretty quickly. We waded out past the rocks where, lashed to a depth marker, was a canoe. We clambered into it, and Emma handed me an oar, and we both started paddling, heading toward the lighthouse. The night was warm and the sea calm, and for a few minutes I lost myself in the pleasant rhythm of oars slapping water. About 100 yards from the lighthouse, Emma stopped paddling and stepped overboard. To my amazement, she didn't slip under the waves, but stood up, submerged only to her knees.
"Are you on a sandbar or something?" I asked.
"Nope."
She reached into the canoe, pulled out a little anchor, and dropped it. It fell about 3 feet before stopping with a metallic clang. A moment later, the lighthouse beam swept past, and I saw the hull of a ship stretching beneath us on all sides.
"A shipwreck!"
"Come on," she said. "We're nearly there. And bring your mask."
She started walking across the wrecked boat's hull. I stepped out gingerly and followed. To anyone watching from shore, it would have looked like we were walking on water.
"How big is this thing anyway?" I said.
"Massive. It's an Allied warship. Hit a friendly mine and sank right here."
She stopped.
"Look away from the lighthouse for a minute," she said. "Let your eyes get used to the dark."
So we stood facing the shore and waited as small waves slapped at our thighs.
"All right, now follow me and take a giant breath."
She walked over to a dark hole in the ship's hull, a door from the look of it, then sat down on the edge and plunged in. "This is insane," I thought, and then I strapped on the mask she'd given me and plunged in after her. I peered into the enveloping blackness between my feet to see Emma pulling herself even farther down by the rungs of a ladder. I grabbed the top of it and followed, descending hand over hand until it stopped at a metal floor where she was waiting. We seemed to be in some sort of cargo hold, though it was too dark to tell much more than that. I tapped her elbow and pointed to my mouth.
"I need to breathe."
She patted my arm condescendingly and reached for a length of plastic tubing that hung nearby. It was connected to a pipe that ran up the ladder to the surface. She put the tube in her mouth and blew, her cheeks puffing out with the effort, then took a breath from it and passed it to me. I sucked in a welcome lungful of air. We were 20 feet underwater inside an old shipwreck, and we were breathing. Emma pointed at a doorway in front of us, little more than a black hole in the murk. I shook my head. "Don't want to." But she took my hand as though I were a frightened toddler and led me toward it, bringing the tube along.
We drifted through the doorway into total darkness. For a while, we just hung there, passing the breathing tube between us. There was no sound but our breaths bubbling up and obscure thuds from deep inside the ship, pieces of the broken hull knocking in the current. If I had shut my eyes, it wouldn't have been any darker. We were like astronauts floating in a starless universe. But then, a baffling and magnificent thing happened. One by one, the stars came out. Here and there, a green flash in the dark. I thought I was hallucinating. But then more lit up, and still more, until a whole constellation surged around us like a million green twinkling stars, lighting our bodies, reflecting in our masks. Emma held out a hand and flicked a wrist, but rather than producing a ball of fire, her hand glowed a scintillating blue. The green stars coalesced around it, flashing and whirling, echoing her movements like a school of fish, which, I realized, is just what they were. Mesmerized, I lost all track of time. We stayed there for what seemed like hours, though it was probably only a few minutes. Then I felt Emma nudge me, and we retreated through the doorway and up the ladder, and when we broke the surface again, the first thing I saw was the great bold stripe of the Milky Way painted across the heavens, and it occurred to me that together, the fish and the stars formed a complete system, coincident parts of some ancient and mysterious whole. We pulled ourselves onto the hull and took off our masks. For a while, we just sat like that, half-submerged, thighs touching, speechless. "What were those?" I said finally.
"We call them flashlight fish. I've never seen one before." "Most people never do," she said. "They hide. They're beautiful."
"Yes, and peculiar."
Emma smiled.
"They are that, too."
And then her hand crept onto my knee, and I let it stay there because it felt warm and good in the cool water. I listened for the voice in my head telling me not to kiss her, but it had gone silent. And then we were kissing. The profoundness of our lips touching, and our tongues pressing, and my hand cupping her perfect white cheek barred any thoughts of right or wrong, or any memory of why I had followed her there in the first place. We were kissing and kissing, and then suddenly, it was over. As she pulled away, I followed her face with mine. She put a hand on my chest, at once gentle and firm.
"I need to breathe, dummy."
I laughed.
"Okay."
She took my hands and looked at me, and I looked back. It was almost more intense than kissing, the just looking. And then she said,
"You should stay."
"Stay," I repeated.
"Here. With us."
The reality of her words filtered through, and the tingly magic of what had just happened between us numbed out.
"I want to, but I don't think I can." "Why not?"
I considered the idea. The sun, the feasts, the friends, and the sameness, the perfect, identical days. You can get sick of anything if you have too much of it. Like all the petty luxuries my mother bought and quickly grew bored with. But Emma. There was Emma. Maybe it wasn't so strange what we could have. Maybe I could stay for a while and love her and then go home. But no. By the time I wanted to leave, it would be too late. She was a siren. I had to be strong.
"It's him you want, not me. I can't be him for you."
She looked away, stung.
"That isn't why you should stay. You belong here, Jacob."
"I don't. I'm not like you."
"Yes, you are," she insisted.
"I'm not. I'm common, just like my grandfather." Emma shook her head.
"Is that really what you think?"
"If I could do something spectacular like you, don't you think I would have noticed by now?"
"I'm not meant to tell you this," she said, "but common people can't pass through time loops."
I considered this for a moment, but couldn't make sense of it. "There's nothing peculiar about me. I'm the most average person you'll ever meet."
"I doubt that very much," she replied. Abe had a rare and peculiar talent, something almost no one else could do. And then she met my eyes and said, he could see the monsters.
Chapter 9.
He could see the monsters. The moment she said it, all the horrors I thought I'd put behind me came flooding back. They were real. They were real, and they'd killed my grandfather. I can see them too, I told her, whispering it like a secret shame. Her eyes welled, and she embraced me. I knew there was something peculiar about you, she said, and I mean that as the highest compliment. I'd always known I was strange. I never dreamed I was peculiar. But if I could see things almost no one else could, it explained why Ricky hadn't seen anything in the woods the night my grandfather was killed. It explained why everyone thought I was crazy. I wasn't crazy, or seeing things, or having a stress reaction. The panicky twist in my gut whenever they were close, that and the awful sight of them, that was my gift. And you can't see them at all? I asked her. Only their shadows, which is why they hunt mainly at night. What's stopping them from coming after you right now? I asked, then corrected myself. All of us, I mean. She turned serious. They don't know where to find us. That and they can't enter loops, so we're safe on the island, but we can't leave. But Victor did. She nodded sadly. He said he was going mad here, said he couldn't stand it any longer. Poor Bronwyn. My Abe left too, but at least he wasn't murdered by Hollows. I forced myself to look at her. I'm really sorry to have to tell you this. What? Oh, no. They convinced me it was wild animals, but if what you're saying is true, my grandfather was murdered by them too. The first and only time I saw one was the night he died. She hugged her knees to her chest and closed her eyes. I slid my arm around her, and she tilted her head against mine. I knew they'd get him eventually, she whispered. He promised me he'd be safe in America, that he could protect himself. But we're never safe, none of us, not really. We sat talking on the wrecked ship until the moon got low and the water lapped at our throats and Emma began to shiver. Then we linked hands and waded back to the canoe. Paddling toward the beach, we heard voices calling our names, and then we came around a rock and saw Hugh and Fiona waving at us on the shore. Even from a distance, it was clear something was wrong. We tied the canoe and ran to meet them. Hugh was out of breath, bees darting around him in a state of agitation. Something's happened. You've got to come back with us. There was no time to argue. Emma pulled her clothes over her swimsuit, and I tripped into my pants all gritty with sand. Hugh regarded me uncertainly. Not him, though, he said. This is serious. No, Hugh, Emma said. The bird was right. He's one of us. He gaped at her, then at me. You told him? I had to. He practically worked it out for himself anyway. Hugh seemed taken back for a moment, but then turned and gave me a resolute handshake. Then welcome to the family. I didn't know what to say, so I just said, thanks. On the way to the house, we gleaned sketchy bits of information from Hugh about what had happened, but mostly we just ran. When we stopped in the woods to catch our breath, he said, it's one of the bird's Embrin friends. She winged in an hour ago in a terrible state, yelling blue murder and rousing everyone from their beds. Before we could understand what she was getting at, she fainted dead off. He wrung his hands, looking miserable. Oh, I just know something wicked's happened. I hope you're wrong, Emma said, and we ran on. In the hall, just outside the sitting room's closed door, children in rumpled nightclothes huddled around a kerosene lantern, trading rumors about what might have happened. Perhaps they forgot to reset their loop, said Claire.
Bet you it was Hollows, Enoch said. Bet they ate the lot of them, too, right down to their boots.
Claire and Olive wailed and clapped their little hands over their faces. Horace knelt beside them and said in a comforting voice,
"There, there. Don't let Enoch fill your heads with rubbish. Everyone knows Hollows like young ones best. That's why they let Miss Peregrine's friend go. She tastes like old coffee grounds."
Olive peeked out from between her fingers.
"What do young ones taste like?"
"Lingonberries,"
he said matter-of-factly. The girls wailed again.
"Leave them alone,"
Hugh shouted, and a squadron of bees sent Horace yelping down the hall.
"What's going on out there?"
Miss Peregrine called from inside the sitting room.
"Is that Mr. Appleston I hear? Where are Miss Bloom and Mr. Portman?"
Emma cringed and shot Hugh a nervous look.
"She knows? When she found out you were gone, she just about went off her chump. Thought you'd been abducted by whites or some balminess. Sorry, Em, I had to tell her."
Emma shook her head, but all we could do was go in and face the music. Fiona gave us a little salute, as if to wish us luck, and we opened the doors. Inside the sitting room, the only light was a hearth fire that threw our quivering shadows against the wall. Bronwyn hovered anxiously around an old woman who was teetering half-conscious in a chair, mummied up in a blanket. Miss Peregrine sat on an ottoman, feeding the woman spoonfuls of dark liquid. When Emma saw her face, she froze.
"Oh, my God," she whispered. "It's Miss Avocet."
Only then did I recognize her, though just barely, from the photograph Miss Peregrine had showed me of herself as a young girl. Miss Avocet had seemed so indomitable then, but now she looked frail and weak. As we stood watching, Miss Peregrine brought a silver flask to Miss Avocet's lips and tipped it, and for a moment, the elder Imbrin seemed to revive, sitting forward with brightening eyes. But then, her expression dulled again, and she sank back into the chair.
"Miss Bruntley," said Miss Peregrine to Bronwyn, "go and make up the fainting couch for Miss Avocet, and then fetch a bottle of cocoa wine and another flask of brandy."
Bronwyn trooped out, nodding solemnly as they passed. Next, Miss Peregrine turned to us and said in a low voice,
"I am tremendously disappointed in you, Miss Bloom. Tremendously. And of all the nights to sneak away. I'm sorry, miss, but how was I to know something bad would happen? I should punish you. However, given the circumstances, it hardly seems worth the effort."
She raised a hand and smoothed her mentor's white hair.
"Miss Avocet would never have left her wards to come here unless something dire had taken place."
The roaring fire made beads of sweat break out on my forehead, but in her chair, Miss Avocet lay shivering. Would she die? Was the tragic scene that had played out between my grandfather and me about to play out again, this time between Miss Peregrine and her teacher? I pictured it, me holding my grandfather's body, terrified and confused, never suspecting the truth about him or myself. What was happening now, I decided, was nothing like what had happened to me. Miss Peregrine had always known who she was. It hardly seemed like the time to bring it up, but I was angry and couldn't help myself. "Miss Peregrine," I began, and she looked up. "When were you going to tell me?" She was about to ask, "What?" But then her eyes went to Emma, and she seemed to read the answer on her face. For a moment, she looked mad, but then she saw my anger, and her own faded.
"Soon, lad. Please understand. To have laid the entire truth upon you at our first meeting would have been an awful shock. Your behavior was unpredictable. You might have fled, never to return. I could not take that risk."
"So instead you tried to seduce me with food and fun and girls while keeping all the bad things a secret?" Emma gasped.
"Seduce? Oh, please, don't think that of me, Jacob. I couldn't bear it." "I fear you badly misjudged us," said Miss Peregrine. "As for seducing you, what you've seen is how we live. There has been no deception, only the withholding of a few facts.
Well, here's a fact for you, I said. One of those creatures killed my grandfather.
Miss Peregrine stared at the fire for a moment. I am very sorry to hear that.
I saw one with my own eyes. When I told people about it, they tried to convince me I was crazy, but I wasn't, and neither was my grandfather. His whole life, he'd been telling me the truth, and I didn't believe him. Shame flooded over me. If I had, maybe he'd still be alive.
Miss Peregrine saw that I was wobbling and offered me the chair across from Miss Avocet. I sat, and Emma knelt down beside me.
Abe must have known you were peculiar, she said, and he must have had a good reason for not telling you.
He did indeed know, replied Miss Peregrine. He said as much in a letter.
I don't understand, then. If it was all true, all his stories, and if he knew I was like him, why did he keep it a secret until the last minute of his life?
Miss Peregrine spoon-fed more brandy to Miss Avocet, who groaned and sat up a little before settling back into the chair.
I can only imagine that he wanted to protect you, she said. Ours can be a life of trials and deprivations. Abe's life was doubly so because he was born a Jew in the worst of times. He faced a double genocide, of Jews by the Nazis and of peculiars by the Holocaust. He was tormented by the idea that he was hiding here while his people, both Jews and peculiars, were being slaughtered.
He used to say he'd gone to war to fight monsters, I said.
He did, said Emma.
The war ended the Nazis' rule, but the Holocaust emerged stronger than ever, Miss Peregrine continued. So like many peculiars, we remained in hiding. But your grandfather returned a changed man. He'd become a warrior, and he was determined to build a life for himself outside the loop. He refused to hide.
I begged him not to go to America, Emma said. We all did.
Why did he choose America? I asked.
It had few Holocaust at that time, Miss Peregrine replied. After the war, there was a minor exodus of peculiars to America. For a while, many were able to pass as common, as your grandfather did. It was his fondest wish to be common, to live a common life. He often mentioned it in his letters. I'm sure that's why he kept the truth from you for so long. He wanted for you what he could never have for himself.
To be ordinary, I said.
Miss Peregrine nodded. But he could never escape his peculiarity, his unique skill, coupled with the prowess he'd honed during the war as a hunter of hollows, made him too valuable. He was often pressed into service, asked to help eradicate troublesome pockets of hollows. His nature was such that he rarely refused.
I thought about all the long hunting trips Grandpa Portman used to go on. My family had a picture of him taken during one of these, though I don't know who took it or when, since he almost always went alone. But when I was a kid, I thought it was the funniest thing because, in the picture, he's wearing a suit. Who brings a suit on a hunting trip? Now I knew, someone who's hunting more than just animals. I was moved by this new idea of my grandfather, not as a paranoiac gun nut, or a secretive philanderer, or a man who wasn't there for his family, but as a wandering knight who risked his life for others, living out of cars and cheap motels, stalking lethal shadows, coming home shy a few bullets, and marked with bruises he can never quite explain, and nightmares he couldn't talk about. For his many sacrifices, he received only scorn and suspicion from those he loved. I guess that's why he wrote so many letters to Emma and Miss Peregrine. They understood. Bronwyn returned with a decanter of cocoa wine and another flask of brandy. Miss Peregrine sent her away and set about mixing them together in a teacup. Then she began to pat Miss Avocet gently on her blue, veined cheek.
Esmeralda, she said, Esmeralda, you must rouse yourself and drink this tonic I've prepared." Miss Avocet moaned, and Miss Peregrine raised the teacup to her lips. The old woman took a few sips, and though she sputtered and coughed, most of the purplish liquid disappeared down her throat. For a moment, she stared, as if about to sink back into her stupor, but then she sat forward, face brightening.
"Oh, my," she said, her voice a dry rasp. "Have I fallen asleep? How indecorous of me."
She looked at us in mild surprise, as if we'd appeared out of nowhere.
"Alma, is that you?"
Miss Peregrine kneaded the old woman's bony hands.
"Esmeralda, you've come a long way to see us in the dead of night. I'm afraid you've got us all terribly worked up."
"Have I?"
Miss Avocet squinted and furrowed her brow, and her eyes seemed to fix on the opposite wall, alive with flickering shadows. Then a haunted expression stole across her face.
"Yes," she said, "I've come to warn you, Alma. You must be on your guard. You mustn't allow yourselves to be taken by surprise as I was."
Miss Peregrine stopped kneading.
"By what?" "They could only have been whites. A pair of them came into the night, disguised as council members. There are no male council members, of course, but it fooled my sleep-dazed wards just long enough for the whites to bind them and drag them away."
Miss Peregrine gasped.
"Oh, Esmeralda!"
"Miss Bunting and I were awoken by their anguished cries," she explained, "but we found ourselves barricaded inside the house. It took some time to force the doors, but when we did and followed the white stink out of the loop, there was a gang of shadow beasts lying in wait on the other side. They fell upon us, howling."
She stopped, choking back tears.
"And the children?"
Miss Avocet shook her head. All the light seemed to have gone out of her eyes.
"The children were merely bait," she said.
Emma slid her hand into mine and squeezed, and I saw Miss Peregrine's cheeks glisten in the firelight.
"It was Miss Bunting and myself whom they wanted. I was able to escape, but Miss Bunting was not so fortunate."
"She was killed?"
"No, abducted. Just as Miss Wren and Miss Tree Creeper were when their loops were invaded a fortnight ago. They're taking Imbrins, Alma. It's some sort of coordinated effort. For what purpose, I shudder to imagine."
"Then they'll come for us too,"
Miss Peregrine said quietly.
"If they can find you," replied Miss Avocet. "You are better hidden than most, but you must be ready, Alma."
Miss Peregrine nodded. Miss Avocet looked helplessly at her hands, trembling in her lap like a broken winged bird. Her voice began to hitch.
"Oh, my dear children, pray for them. They are all alone now."
And she turned away and wept. Miss Peregrine pulled the blanket around the old woman's shoulders and rose. We followed her out, leaving Miss Avocet to her grief. We found the children huddled around the sitting room door. If they hadn't heard everything Miss Avocet had said, they'd heard enough, and it showed on their anxious faces.
"Poor Miss Avocet,"
Claire whimpered, her bottom lip trembling.
"Poor Miss Avocet's children," said Olive.
"Are they coming for us now, miss?"
asked Horace.
"We'll need weapons," cried Millard.
"Battle axes," said Enoch.
"Bombs," said Hugh.
"Stop that at once," Miss Peregrine shouted, raising her hands for quiet. "We must all remain calm. Yes, what happened to Miss Avocet was tragic, profoundly so, but it was a tragedy that need not be repeated here. However, we must be on watch. Henceforth, you will travel beyond the house only with my consent, and then only in pairs. Should you observe a person unknown to you, even if they appear to be peculiar,
Come immediately and inform me. We'll discuss these and other precautionary measures in the morning. Until then, to bed with you. This is no hour for a meeting.
But, miss, Enoch began.
To bed.
The children scurried off to their rooms.
As for you, Mr. Portman, I'm not terribly comfortable with you traveling alone. I think perhaps you should stay, at least until things calm a bit.
I can't just disappear. My dad will flip out. She frowned.
In that case, you must at least spend the night.
I insist upon it. I will, but only if you'll tell me everything you know about the creatures that killed my grandfather.
She tilted her head, studying me with something like amusement. Very well, Mr. Portman. I won't argue with your need to know. Install yourself on the divan for the evening and we'll discuss it first thing.
It has to be now. I'd waited 10 years to hear the truth, and I couldn't wait another minute.
Please. At times, young man, you tread a precariously thin line between being charmingly headstrong and insufferably pig-headed.
She turned to Emma.
Miss Bloom, would you fetch my flask of cocoa wine? It seems I won't be sleeping tonight, and I shall have to indulge if I am to keep awake.
The study was too close to the children's bedrooms for a late-night talk, so the headmistress and I adjourned to a little greenhouse that edged the woods. We sat on overturned planters among climbing roses, a kerosene lantern on the grass between us, dawn not yet broken beyond the glass walls. Miss Peregrine drew a pipe from her pocket and bent to light it in the lamp flame. She drew a few thoughtful puffs, sending up wreaths of blue smoke, then began.
In ancient times, people mistook us for gods, she said, but we peculiars are no less mortal than common folk. Time loops merely delay the inevitable, and the price we pay for using them is hefty. An irrevocable divorce from the ongoing present. As you know, long-term loop dwellers can but dip their toes into the present lest they wither and die. This has been the arrangement since time immemorial. She took another puff, then continued. Some years ago, around the turn of the last century, a splinter faction emerged among our people. A coterie of disaffected peculiars with dangerous ideas. They believed they had discovered a method by which the function of time loops can be perverted to confer upon the user a kind of immortality, not merely the suspension of aging, but the reversal of it. They spoke of eternal youth enjoyed outside the confines of loops, of jumping back and forth from future to past with impunity. Suffering none of the ill effects that have always prevented such recklessness. In other words, of mastering time without being mastered by death. The whole notion was mad. Absolute bunkum. A refutation of the empirical laws that govern everything.
She exhaled sharply, then paused for a moment to collect herself.
In any case, my two brothers, technically brilliant but rather lacking in sense, were taken with the idea. They even had the audacity to request my assistance in making it a reality. You're talking about making yourselves into gods, I said. It can't be done, and even if it can, it shouldn't. But they would not be deterred. Having grown up among Miss Avocet's imbrines in training, they knew more about our unique art than most peculiar males. Just enough, I'm afraid, to be dangerous. Despite warnings, even threats from the council, in the summer of 1908, my brothers and several hundred members of this renegade faction, a number of powerful imbrins among them, traitors every one, ventured into the Siberian tundra to conduct their hateful experiment. For the site they chose a nameless old loop unused for centuries. We expected them to return within a week, tails between their legs,
humbled by the immutable nature of nature. Instead, their comeuppance was far more dramatic. A catastrophic explosion that rattled windows as far as the Azores. Anyone within 500 kilometers surely thought it was the end of the world. We assumed they'd all been killed. That obscene, world-cracking bang, their last collective utterance. But they survived, I guessed. In a manner of speaking, others might call the state of being they subsequently assumed a kind of living damnation. Weeks later, they began a series of attacks upon peculiars by awful creatures who, apart from their shadows, could not be seen except by peculiars like yourself, our very first clashes with the Holocaust. It was some time before we realized that these tentacle-mawed abominations were in fact our wayward brothers, crawled from the smoking crater left behind by their experiment. Rather than becoming gods, they had transformed themselves into devils. What went wrong? That is still a matter of debate. One theory is that they reverse-aged themselves to a time before even their souls had been conceived, which is why we call them Holocaust, because their hearts, their souls, are empty. In a cruel twist of irony, they achieve the immortality they'd been seeking. It's believed that the Hollows can live thousands of years, but it is a life of constant physical torment, of humiliating debasement, feeding on stray animals, living in isolation, and of insatiable hunger for the flesh of their former kin, because our blood is their only hope for salvation. If a Hollow gorges itself on enough peculiars, it becomes a white. That word again, I said. When we first met, Emma accused me of being one. I might have thought the same thing if I hadn't observed you beforehand. What are they? If being a Hollow is a living hell, and it most certainly is, then being a white is akin to purgatory. Whites are almost common. They have no peculiar abilities, but because they can pass for human, they live in servitude to their Hollow brethren, acting as scouts and spies and procurers of flesh. It's a hierarchy of the damned that aims someday to turn all Hollows into whites and all peculiars into corpses. But what's stopping them? I said. If they used to be peculiar, don't they know all your hiding places? Fortunately, they don't appear to retain any memory of their former lives, and though whites aren't as strong or as frightening as Hollows, they're often just as dangerous. Unlike Hollows, they're ruled by more than instinct and are often able to blend into the general population. It can be difficult to distinguish them from common folk, though there are certain indicators. Their eyes, for instance. Curiously, whites lack pupils. I broke out in goosebumps, remembering the white-eyed neighbor I'd seen watering his overgrown lawn the night my grandfather was killed. I think I've seen one. I thought he was just an old blind man. Then you are more observant than most, she said. Whites are adept at passing unnoticed. They tend to adopt personas invisible to society. The gray-suited man on the train, the indigent begging for spare coins, just faces in the crowd. Though some have been known to risk exposure by placing themselves in more prominent positions, physicians, politicians, clergymen, in order to interact with a greater number of people, or to have some measure of power over them, so that they can more easily discover peculiars who might be hiding among common folk, as Abe was. Miss Peregrine reached for a photo album she'd brought from the house and began to flip through it. These have been reproduced and distributed to peculiars everywhere, rather like wanted posters. Look here, she said, pointing to a picture of two girls astride a fake reindeer, a chilling, blank-eyed Santa Claus peeping out through its antlers.
This white was discovered working in an American department store at Christmas. He was able to interact with a great many children in a remarkably short time, touching them, interrogating them, screening for signs of peculiarity. She turned the page to reveal a photo of a sadistic-looking dentist. This white worked as an oral surgeon. It wouldn't surprise me to learn that the skull he's posing with belonged to one of his peculiar victims. She flipped the page again, this time to a picture of a little girl cowering before a looming shadow. This is Marcy. She left us 30 years ago to live with a common family in the countryside. I pleaded with her to stay, but she was determined. Not long after, she was snatched by a white as she waited for the school bus. A camera was found at the scene with this undeveloped picture inside. Who took it? The white himself. They are fond of dramatic gestures and invariably leave behind some taunting memento. I studied the pictures, a small, familiar dread turning inside me. When I couldn't bear to look at the pictures anymore, I shut the album. I tell you all this because to know it is your birthright, Miss Peregrine said, but also because I need your help. You are the only one among us who can go outside the loop without arousing suspicion. So long as you're with us, and you insist upon traveling back and forth, I need you to watch for new arrivals to the island and report them to me. There was one just the other day, I said, thinking of the birder who had upset my dad. Did you see his eyes? She asked. Not really, it was dark, and he was wearing a big hat that hid part of his face. Miss Peregrine chewed her knuckle, her brow furrowing. Why? Do you think he could be one of them? It's impossible to be certain without seeing the eyes, she said, but the possibility that you were followed to the island concerns me very much. What do you mean? By a white? Perhaps the very one you describe seeing on the night of your grandfather's death. It would explain why they chose to spare your life, so that you could lead them to an even richer prize, this place. But how could they have known I was peculiar? I didn't even know. If they knew about your grandfather, you can be certain they knew about you as well. I thought about all the chances they must have had to kill me. All the times I'd felt them nearby in the weeks after Grandpa Portman died. Had they been watching me? Waiting for me to do exactly what I did and come here? Feeling overwhelmed, I put my head down on my knees. I don't suppose you could let me have a sip of that wine, I said. Absolutely not. All of a sudden, I felt my chest clench up. Will I ever be safe anywhere? I asked her. Miss Peregrine touched my shoulder. You're safe here, she said, and you may live with us as long as you like. I tried to speak, but all that came out was little stutters. But I can't. My parents. They may love you, she whispered, but they'll never understand. By the time I got back to town, the sun was casting its first long shadows across the streets. All-night drinkers were wheeling around lampposts on their reluctant journeys home. Fishermen were trudging soberly to the harbor in great black boots, and my father was just beginning to stir from a heavy sleep. As he rolled out of his bed, I was crawling into mine, pulling the covers over my sandy clothes, only seconds before he opened the door to check on me. Feeling okay? I groaned and rolled away from him, and he went out. Late that afternoon, I woke to find a sympathetic note and a packet of flu pills on the common room table. I smiled and felt briefly guilty for lying to him. Then I began to worry about him. Out there, wandering across the headlands with his binoculars and little notebook, possibly in the company of a sheep-murdering madman. Rubbing the sleep from my eyes and throwing on a rain jacket, I walked the circuit around the village and then around the nearby cliffs and beaches
hoping to see either my father or the strange ornithologist and get a good look at his eyes, but I didn't find either of them. It was nearing dusk when I finally gave up and returned to the priest hole, where I found my father at the bar, tipping back a beer with the regulars. Judging from the empty bottles around him, he'd been there a while. I sat down next to him and asked if he'd seen the bearded birder. He said he hadn't. "Well, if you do," I said, "do me a favor and keep your distance, okay?" He looked at me strangely. "Why?" "He just rubs me the wrong way. What if he's some nutcase? What if he's the one who killed those sheep? Where do you get these bizarre ideas?" I wanted to tell him. I wanted to explain everything, and for him to tell me he understood and offer some tidbit of parental advice. I wanted, in that moment, for everything to go back to the way it had been before we came here, before I ever found that letter from Miss Peregrine, back when I was just a sort of normal messed-up rich kid in the suburbs. Instead, I sat next to my dad for a while and talked about nothing. And I tried to remember what my life had been like in that unfathomably distant era that was 4 weeks ago, or imagine what it might be like 4 weeks from now, but I couldn't. Eventually, we ran out of nothing to talk about, and I excused myself and went upstairs to be alone. Chapter 10. On Tuesday night, most of what I thought I understood about myself had turned out to be wrong. On Sunday morning, my dad and I were supposed to pack our things and go home. I had just a few days to decide what to do. Stay or go? Neither option seemed good. How could I possibly stay here and leave behind everything I'd known? But after all I'd learned, how could I go home? Even worse, there was no one I could talk to about it. Dad was out of the question. Emma made frequent and passionate arguments as to why I should stay, none of which acknowledged the life I would be abandoning, however meager it seemed, or how the sudden inexplicable disappearance of their only child might affect my parents, or the stifling suffocation that Emma herself had admitted feeling inside the loop. She would only say, "With you here, it'll be better." Miss Peregrine was even less helpful. Her only answer was that she couldn't make such a decision for me, even though I only wanted to talk it through. Still, it was obvious she wanted me to stay. Beyond my own safety, my presence in the loop would make everyone else safer. But I didn't relish the idea of spending my life as their watchdog. I was beginning to suspect my grandfather had felt the same way, and it was part of the reason he'd refused to return after the war. Joining the peculiar children would also mean I wouldn't finish high school, or go to college, or do any of the normal growing up things people do. Then again, I had to keep reminding myself, I wasn't normal. And as long as Hollows were hunting me, any life lived outside the loop would almost certainly be cut short. I'd spend the rest of my days living in fear, looking over my shoulder, tormented by nightmares, waiting for them to finally come back and punch my ticket. That sounded a lot worse than missing out on college. Then I thought, isn't there a third option? Couldn't I be like Grandpa Portman, who for 50 years had lived and thrived and fended off Hollows outside the loop? That's when the self-deprecating voice in my head kicked in. He was military trained, dummy. A stone-cold badass. He had a walk-in closet full of sawed-off shotguns. The man was Rambo compared to you. I could sign up for a class at the gun range, the optimistic part of me would think. Take karate. Work out. Are you joking? You couldn't even protect yourself in high school. You had to bribe that redneck to be your bodyguard. And you'd wet your pants if you so much as pointed a real gun at anyone. No, I wouldn't. You're weak. You're a loser. That's why he never told you who you really were. He knew you couldn't handle it. Shut up. Shut up. For days, I went back and forth like this. Stay or go. I obsessed constantly without resolution. Meanwhile, Dad completely lost steam on his book, The less he worked, the more discouraged he got. And the more discouraged he got, the more time he spent in the bar. I'd never seen him drink that way. 6, 7 beers a night. And I didn't want to be around him when he was like that. He was dark. And when he wasn't sulking in silence, he would tell me things I really didn't want to know.
"One of these days your mother's gonna leave me," he said one night. "If I don't make something happen pretty soon, I really think she might."
I started avoiding him. I'm not sure he even noticed. It became depressingly easy to lie about my comings and goings. Meanwhile, at the Home for Peculiar Children, Miss Peregrine instituted a near lockdown. It was like martial law had been declared. The smaller kids couldn't go anywhere without an escort. The older ones traveled in pairs, and Miss Peregrine had to know where everyone was at all times. Just getting permission to go outside was an ordeal. Sentries were drafted into rotating shifts to watch the front and rear of the house. At all times of the day, and most of the night, you could see bored faces peeping out of windows. If they spotted someone approaching, they yanked a pull chain that rang a bell in Miss Peregrine's room, which meant that whenever I arrived, she'd be waiting inside the door to interrogate me. What was happening outside the loop? Had I seen anything strange? Was I sure I hadn't been followed? Not surprisingly, the kids began to go a little nuts. The little ones got rambunctious, while the older ones moped, complaining about the new rules in voices just loud enough to be overheard. Dramatic sighs erupted out of thin air, often the only cue that Millard had wandered into a room. Hugh's insects swarmed and stung people until they were banished from the house, after which Hugh spent all his time at the window, his bees screening the other side of the glass. Olive, claiming she had misplaced her leaden shoes, took to crawling around the ceiling like a fly, dropping grains of rice on people's heads until they looked up and noticed her, at which point she'd burst into laughter, so all-consuming that her levitation would falter and she'd have to grab onto a chandelier or curtain rod just to keep from falling. Strangest of all was Enoch, who disappeared into his basement laboratory to perform experimental surgeries on his clay soldiers that would have made Dr. Frankenstein cringe, amputating the limbs from 2 to make a hideous Spider-Man of a 3rd, or cramming 4 chicken hearts into a single chest cavity in an attempt to create a super clay man who would never run out of energy. One by one, their little gray bodies failed under the strain, and the basement came to resemble a Civil War field hospital. For her part, Miss Peregrine remained in a constant state of motion, chain-smoking pipes while limping from room to check on the children, as if they might disappear the moment they left her sight. Miss Avocet stayed on, emerging from her torpor now and then to wander the halls, calling out forlornly for her poor, abandoned wards before slumping into someone's arms to be taken back to bed. There followed a great deal of paranoid speculation about Miss Avocet's tragic ordeal and why Hollows would want to kidnap Imbrins, with theories ranging from the bizarre to create the biggest time loop in history, large enough to swallow the whole planet, to the ridiculously optimistic, to keep the Hollows company. Being a horrible soul-eating monster can get pretty lonely. Eventually, a morbid quiet settled over the house. 2 days of confinement had made everyone lethargic. Believing that routine was the best defense against depression, Miss Peregrine tried to keep everyone interested in her daily lessons, in preparing the daily meals, and in keeping the house spick and span. But whenever they weren't under direct orders to do something, the children sank heavily into chairs, stared listlessly out locked windows, paged through dog-eared books they'd read 100 times before, or slept. I'd never seen Horace's peculiar talent in action until, one evening, he began to scream. A bunch of us rushed upstairs to the garret, where he'd been on sentry duty, to find him rigid in a chair in the grips of what seemed to be a waking nightmare, clawing at the air in horror. At first, his screaming was just that, but then he began to babble, yelling about the seas boiling and ash raining from the sky and an endless blanket of smoke smothering the earth. After a few minutes of these apocalyptic pronouncements, he seemed to wear himself out and fell into an uneasy sleep. The others had seen this happen before, often enough that there were photos of his episodes in Miss Peregrine's album, and they knew what to do. Under the headmistress's direction, they carried him by the arms and legs to bed, and when he woke a few hours later, he claimed he couldn't remember the dream, and that dreams he couldn't remember rarely came true. The others accepted this because they already had too much else to worry about. I sensed he was holding something back. When someone goes missing in a town as small as Cairnholm, it doesn't go unnoticed. That's why on Wednesday, when Martin failed to open his museum or stop by the priest hole for his customary nightcap, people began to wonder if he was sick. And when Kev's wife went to check on him and found his front door hanging open and his wallet and glasses on the kitchen counter but no one at home, people began to wonder if he was dead. When he still hadn't turned up the next day, a gang of men was dispatched to open sheds and peer beneath overturned boats, searching anywhere a wifeless man who loved whiskey might sleep off a binge. But they'd only just begun when a call came in over the short band radio. Martin's body had been fished out of the ocean. I was in the pub with my dad when the fisherman who'd found him came in. It was hardly past noon, but he was issued a beer on principle, and within minutes, the man was telling his story.
"I was up Gannett's Point reeling in me nets," he began. "They was as heavy as anything, which was odd, since all's I generally catch out that a ways is just tidy little nothings, shrimps and such. Thought I'd got snagged on a crab trap, so I grab for the gaff and poke around under the boat till it hooks on something."
We all scooted closer on our stools, like it was story time in some morbid kindergarten.
"It was Martin, all right. Looked like he'd taken a quick trip down a cliffside and got nibbled by sharks. Lord knows what business he had being out by them cliffs in the dead of night in just his robe and trolleys."
"He weren't dressed?" Kev asked.
"Dressed for bed, maybe," said the fisherman. "Not for a walk in the wet."
Brief prayers were muttered for Martin's soul, and then people began trading theories. Within minutes, the place was a smoke-filled den of tipsy Sherlock Holmeses.
"He could have been drunk," one man ventured.
"Or if he was out by the cliffs, maybe he seen the sheep killer and was chasing after," said another.
"What about that squirrely new fella?" the fisherman said. "The one who's camping."
My father straightened on his bar stool.
"I ran into him," he said, 2 nights ago.
I turned to him in surprise. "You didn't tell me."
"I was going to the chemist, trying to catch him before he closed, and this guy's headed the other way, out of town, in a huge hurry. I bump his shoulder as he passes, just to ruffle him. He stops and stares at me, trying to be intimidating. I get in his face, tell him I want to know what he's doing here and what he's working on, because people here talk about themselves," I say.
Kev leaned across the bar.
"And?"
"He looks like he's about to take a swing at me, but then just walks off."
A lot of the men had questions. What an ornithologist does, why the guy was camping, and other things I already knew. I had only one question, which I'd been itching to ask. "Did you notice anything strange about him? About his face?" My father thought for a second.
"Yeah, actually.
He had on sunglasses."
"At night?"
"Weirdest damn thing."
A sick feeling came over me, and I wondered how close my father had come to something far worse than a fistfight. I knew I had to tell Miss Peregrine about this, and soon.
"Ah, bullocks," said Kev. "There ain't been a murder on Cairnholm in 100 years. Why would anyone want to kill old Martin anyway? It don't make sense. I'll bet you all around that when his autopsy comes back, it says he was arseholed right into the next century."
"Could be a tidy spell before that happens," the fisherman said. "Storm that's rolling in now, weatherman says it's gonna be a right bumper. Worst we've had all year.
Weatherman says, Kev scoffed. I wouldn't trust that silly bugger to know if it's raining now.
The islanders often made gloomy predictions about what Mother Nature had in store for Cairnholm. They were at the mercy of the elements, after all, and pessimistic by default. But this time, their worst fears were confirmed. The wind and rain that had pelted the island all week strengthened that night into a vicious band of storms that closed blackly over the sky and whipped the sea into foam. Between rumors about Martin having been murdered and the weather, the town went into lockdown, much as the children's home had. People stayed in their houses. Windows were shuttered and doors bolted tight. Boats clattered against their moorings in the heavy chop, but none left the harbor. To take one out in such a gale would have been suicidal. And because the mainland police couldn't collect Martin's body until the seas calmed, the townspeople were left with the nettlesome question of what to do with his body. It was finally decided that the fishmonger, who had the island's largest stockpile of ice, would keep him cool in the back of his shop, among salmon and cod and other things, which, like Martin, had been pulled from the sea. I was under strict instructions from my father not to leave the priest hole, but I was also under instructions to report any strange goings-on to Miss Peregrine, and if a suspicious death didn't qualify, nothing did. So that night, I feigned a flu-like illness and locked myself in my room, then slipped out the window and climbed down a drain pipe to the ground. No one else was foolish enough to be outside, so I ran straight down the main path without fear of being spotted, the hood of my jacket scrunched tight against the whipping rain. When I got to the children's home, Miss Peregrine took one look at me and knew something was wrong. "What happened?" she said, her bloodshot eyes ranging over me. I told her everything, all the sketchy facts and rumors I'd overheard, and she blanched. She hurried me into the sitting room, where in a panic she gathered all the kids she could find and then stomped off to find a few who had ignored her shouts. The rest were left to stand around, anxious and confused. Emma and Millard cornered me.
"What's she in such a tiff about?" Millard asked.
I quietly told them about Martin. Millard sucked in his breath, and Emma crossed her arms, looking worried. "Is it really that bad?" I said. "I mean, it can't have been hollows. They only hunt peculiars, right?" Emma groaned.
"Do you want to tell him, or shall I?" "Hollows vastly prefer peculiars over common folk," Millard explained, "but they'll eat just about anything to sustain themselves, so long as it's fresh and meaty."
"It's one of the ways you know there might be a hollow hanging about," said Emma. "The bodies pile up. That's why they're mostly nomads. If they didn't move from place to place so often, they'd be simple to track down."
"How often?" I asked, a shiver tracing my spine. "Do they need to eat, I mean?"
"Oh, pretty often," said Millard. "Arranging the hollows' meals is what whites spend most of their time doing. They look for peculiars when they can, but a gobsmacking portion of their energy and effort is spent tracking down common victims for the hollows, animal and human, and then hiding the mess."
His tone was academic, as if discussing the breeding patterns of a mildly interesting species of rodent.
"But don't the whites get caught?" I said.
"I mean, if they're helping murder people, you'd think..."
"Some do," Emma said. "Wager you've heard of a few, if you follow the news. There was one fellow, they'd found him with human heads in the icebox and giblety goodies in a stockpot over a low boil, like he was making Christmas dinner. In your time, this wouldn't have been so very long ago."
I remembered, vaguely, a sensationalized late-night TV special about a cannibalistic serial killer from Milwaukee who'd been apprehended in similarly gruesome circumstances.
"You mean Jeffrey Dahmer?"
"I believe that was a gentleman's name, yes," said Millard. "Fascinating case. Seems he never lost his taste for the fresh stuff, though he'd not been a hollow for many years."
"I thought you guys weren't supposed to know about the future," I said. Emma flashed a canny smile.
The bird only keeps good things about the future to herself, but you can bet we hear all the brown trouser bits.
Then Miss Peregrine returned, pulling Enoch and Horace behind her by their shirt sleeves. Everyone came to attention.
"We've just had word of a new threat," she announced, giving me an appreciative nod. "A man outside our loop has died under suspicious circumstances. We can't be certain of the cause or whether it represents a true threat to our security, but we must conduct ourselves as if it did. Until further notice, no one may leave the house, not even to collect vegetables or bring in a goose for the evening meal."
A collective groan arose, over which Miss Peregrine raised her voice.
"This has been a challenging few days for all of us. I beg your continued patience."
Hands shot up around the room, but she rebuffed all questions and marched off to secure the doors. I ran after her in a panic. If there really was something dangerous on the island, it might kill me the minute I set foot outside the loop. But if I stayed here, I'd be leaving my father defenseless, not to mention worried sick about me. Somehow, that seemed even worse.
"I need to go,"
I said, catching up to Miss Peregrine. She pulled me into an empty room and closed the door.
"You will keep your voice down," she commanded, "and you will respect my rules. What I said applies to you as well. No one leaves this house. But thus far, I have allowed you an unprecedented measure of autonomy to come and go as you please, out of respect for your unique position. But you may have already been followed here, and that puts my ward's lives in jeopardy. I will not permit you to endanger them or yourself any further."
"Don't you understand?" I said angrily. "Boats aren't running. Those people in town are stuck. My father is stuck. If there really is a white, and it's who I think it is, he and my dad have almost gotten into one fight already. If he just fed a total stranger to a hollow, who do you think he's going after next?" Her face was like stone. "The welfare of the townspeople is none of my concern," she said. "I won't endanger my wards. Not for anyone. It isn't just townspeople, it's my father. Do you really think a couple of locked doors will stop me from going?"
"Perhaps not. But if you insist on leaving here, then I insist you never return."
I was so shocked I had to laugh.
"But you need me," I said.
"Yes, we do," she replied. "We do very much."